So you put together paperwork and everything like that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, the House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome. Please remember to turn off your cell phones. We promise intriguing and good conversation that will make you not want to answer your phone, read your text messages, or check your email. And, of course, you will want to clean tape when you come back to listen because you will have enjoyed this hearing so much. So please help us all relive the great moments by turning your cell phone all the way off and not just on vibrate. We are going to start out with our public hearings on House Bill 2208. And House Bill 2112 before moving into the work sessions that we have posted. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2208. Roxy, would you give us a brief description of what we're looking at in 08?
Yes. Basically, House Bill 2208 does two things. The first is to make a formal change from Department of Higher Education to the Oregon University System. That was informally done in 1999, and Legislative Council recommended that that be a formally changed. The second thing that it does, and I'm not going to pretend to understand this a whole lot, but I'm going to give you my best description of what I think is happening. There are accounts that would be reopened in accounts of the Oregon University System that would allow the interest on those accounts to accrue to the Oregon University Systems, and those interests are currently going to the general fund. So that's the purpose of the accounts. And we have somebody here from Oregon University Systems who will explain it much better than I just did. But that's the background what the bill does.
Great. Thank you. Any questions before we hear from our witnesses who will help us delve deeper into these questions? All right. With that, then, could we please have Tom Hojum from the Oregon Student Association?
Can we have the gentleman from
OUS? Sorry. Mike Green.
Yes.
Tom, I promised to bring you back. Thank you, Mike, and if you'll introduce yourself for the record, that would be great.
Will do. Apologize for my gravelly voice. I'm suffering from some crud, so bear with me. Chair Gessler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Green. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration and Controller for the Oregon University System. I'm pleased to be here today to discuss HB 2208. Before I get into the details of the bill, I want to give you a little bit of background information. Currently, the Oregon University System maintains in excess of 100 cash accounts in accordance with statutory stipulations. Cash balances in these accounts are currently invested by the state treasurer in a short-term fund. OUS retains the investment earnings on 59% of these balances, and the investment earnings on the other 41%, including cash from student tuition and fees, accrue to the general fund. The funds comprised within this 41% of OUS cash balances currently earn $13.9 million per biennium, excluding any general fund appropriations. The current statutory structure of OUS's bank accounts does not allow the state treasurer to consider pooled investment strategies that may improve investment earnings. I don't want to contradict the committee administrator. I said the bill does three things, but one of the things it does is it serves to consolidate these multiple cash accounts into two main cash accounts. It directs the investment earnings on all OUS cash accounts to OUS, excluding the account that would contain the state general fund appropriations, which will continue to accrue investment earnings to the state's general fund. And it includes the housekeeping provisions to refer to the Oregon University System consistently throughout statutes. Excuse me a moment. Passage of HB 2208 will benefit OUS in the following ways. Working together with the state treasurer, OUS would be able to streamline our banking processes and improve operational efficiencies and effectiveness. Having a simplified banking structure will, among other things, reduce reconciliation time and complexity, improve cash flow projections, reduce the number of banking transactions that we do, and reduce the number of accounting software modifications that we maintain. The consolidation of OUS's cash balances would provide the opportunity to achieve economies of scale in investment purchases, reduce the volatility in operating cash flows, stratify the balances based on liquidity needs, and invest those monies more efficiently and effectively to improve investment earnings without exposing the state to undue investment risk. Estimates indicate that OUS could realize millions of dollars in incremental investment earnings through the use of this pooling concept. Incremental investment earnings that result from these changes will be used to reduce costs, improve student services, which are vital to improving access, affordability, and student success within OUS. In a study undertaken at the direction of the 2007 legislature, the Legislative Fiscal Office and the State Treasurer's Office validated this proposed cash management and investment approach. This was reported to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means in December of 2007. Retaining the investment earnings on all cash balances will also provide a natural budgetary hedge for OUS to utilize lower-cost variable-rate debt for financing the construction and major renovations of higher ed facilities once the capital markets stabilize. Estimates indicate that OUS could save millions of dollars in interest costs by issuing a portion of its long-term debt at variable interest rates. HB 2208 has the support of the governor, current state treasurer Ben Westlin, former state treasurer Randall Edwards, the Oregon Student Association, State Board of Higher Education, and all the university presidents. The governor's recommended budget currently includes a $13.9 million reduction in the OUS base budget to compensate the state for the loss of these investment revenues to the general fund. That amount was based on an estimated interest earnings rate of approximately 3.9%. As we're all aware, interest rates are significantly lower today, and based on that new lower rate, the impact of the general fund will only be approximately $7 million. We're very excited at the opportunity these changes would provide for OUS to help our students improve our processes and generate incremental revenues for our universities. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The 41% that goes to the general fund, it just goes to the general fund. It's not allocated to the university system.
Chair Gessler, Representative Van Orman, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Reblin.
Yeah, the different accounts, is there not a way that they could, I mean, is it statutorily that you have to keep those in separate accounts now, and part of what this bill does is allow you to not have to do that? I mean, so it's not entirely because of whether you keep interest or not. I identified all of those accounts.
Representative Roblin, that's correct. It is not entirely. In fact, the investment earnings, incremental earnings, are not anything to do with the investment earnings going one place or another. It's really the banking structure that creates the possibility, if we change it, to pool the monies to gain incremental investment earnings.
Follow up. And so, from the standpoint, if those are individual accounts in the university system, you would still keep books on each of those individual accounts with it going to the other place, so that we aren't losing any information about how that money is spent, correct?
Representative Gelser, Representative Roman, that's exactly correct. We have a very detailed accounting system that has thousands of funds that can separately account for every fund source that we get. If you give us a gift of $1,000 to do a specific thing, we'll set up a fund for that, put that money in that fund, and account for every dollar that's spent in our accounting system.
Representative Bauer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. The question about the ability to use variable interest rate loans, and I mean, how, so you don't have that authority today?
Representative Gelser, Representative Moore, we have the authority, but without earning interest on our operating funds, we don't have the natural hedge that would provide interest earnings to offset any rise in variable rate debt. So in other words, if we don't have the interest earnings and the variable rate debt rises, we don't have an offset of revenue to pay that increased cost.
Madam Chair, follow up?
Yes.
And you're aware of what happened to the variable debt several months ago.
Representative Gelser, Representative Moore, exactly. Part of that well, very aware of what happened in the variable rate debt. We certainly would not enter in the variable rate debt market until and when that market had stabilized. In fact, there's some indication that it has stabilized. Our situation would be quite a bit different than some of the difficulties that they've had. Those were, a lot of those were auction rate securities backed by insurers, and the insurers failed, and say they had a difficulty remarketing those bonds. I believe ours would be GO bonds, would have a different structure, a different financing structure, but clearly we have, you know, the State Treasurer's Office would, as always, does all of our bond issuances. They have financial advisors and bond underwriters that advise them and advise us accordingly, so we're definitely well aware of that, and would not enter into those transactions without fully understanding those risks.
Thank you. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is in some ways a follow-up to Representative Maurer's question, coming at the risk from potential risk from a slightly different angle. Is there risk associated with the consolidation of these into two accounts? Many businesses of very much more modest means than the Oregon University system are spreading money amongst multiple banks now in light of this unprecedented questions of bank failure that we're confronting. Have you considered it from that angle? Is this an issue?
Representative Gelser, Representative Harker, the State Treasurer's Office might be better able to answer that question. Right now, the State Treasurer is our bank, and so all of these funds are invested in the State Treasurer's short-term fund. Behind the short-term fund, the State Treasurer makes decisions on how to invest those monies, and I don't know the puts and takes on that. They would have to answer that question more specifically, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dimbro.
No, I pass.
Any further questions for this witness? Great, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As promised, Tom.
Chair Gelson, members of the committee, my name is Tom Hojum. I work for the Oregon Student Association, which represents more than 100,000 public post-secondary education students across the state of Oregon. I'm here to speak briefly out in favor of House Bill 2208 and as well explain why students are so supportive of this bill. It's not because of the name change, it's not because of the 60 or so pages of technical changes, it's because of the possibility and the potential for this bill to really help student services on their campuses, because any of the incremental increases in funding would go to student services on campus. That's not to say that they don't understand the technical aspects of this bill, because they train students on campus during their voter education and voter registration drives, during which they registered, along with the Student Vote Coalition, more than 25,000 students statewide and educated thousands more on issues like this and funding for post-secondary education. But it's the potential for this helping their retention and their services on campus that really got them initially interested last session, and that's what has sustained their interest over the last 2 years and caused them to once again prioritize this. So that's why students are so invested in this as an issue, and you will see them in the building speaking on it throughout the process of this session. Services are very important to students. Oftentimes they are the canary in the coal mine when funding gets a little bit short. Services are the one to go first. In fact, if you look at the cuts, the 5% cut options that are in place for higher ed right now, they're going to be coming from services on campus. And so this students see this as kind of a way to stabilize funding for services on campus. Additionally, there is a fairness aspect that students tend to bring up first when they speak about this issue, and that is at this point they are paying for most of their public university education. It's around 60% for the whole state, and so they feel that if money is being made off of the money that they pay, that it should stay and help fund their education. So this is something, that piece is also something that you'll be hearing from students throughout the process in this. So at this point, I just would like to conclude by saying that for students, it's all about the services and the fairness aspects, and offer to answer any questions you might have about student support for it.
Thank you. Representative Revlin.
Thank you. You heard the testimony just before us, and you understand that the governor is in favor of this, but at the same time that he estimated how much it would take away, they took that out of the other budget. So it didn't really show up as any additional money to your students' funds. And so I worry, and now we've heard that the estimate that he made may have been a little bit high.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it would have been adjusted back. So I want to make sure that you are clearly in favor, because I, listen to you very carefully, and I want to make sure that people, when they enter into these agreements, are fully aware of the consequences of the actions. And
Chair Gelser, Representative Roblin. Yes, my understanding is that the net gain wouldn't come from, it would come from the more efficient investment, and that while, much of that would depend upon the success of those investments, and that might be less certain given these circumstances in the long term, my understanding is this would eventually be net revenue positive for the system, and that would be good. It's my understanding. Okay. But there's 63 pages, so.
I noticed that myself.
Thank you. Are there further questions for this witness? No? All right. Rexy, did you have something?
No, I'll let you know.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, there are. Could we have Rob Wagner and Melissa Unger, please? Welcome.
Well, thank you. Go ahead. Thank you. So, Chair Gelser, members of the House Education Committee, for the record, my name is Rob Wagner. I'm the Director of Political and Legislative Affairs for the American Federation of Teachers here in Oregon. Our members include faculty or graduate employees at 5 of the 7 OUS campuses. We are here to support House Bill 2208 along with the coalition of students, and you've already heard from the university system. In terms of the technical pieces of the bill, I was joking with Mike Green out in the hall that I used to be an investment banker with Lehman Brothers before I took the job lobbying for AFT Oregon. But I actually can't talk a lot about the details, but I do know I was here last legislative session when this was thoroughly vetted, and there was a lot of work done during the interim on this too. So hopefully that addresses some of the concerns that we're hearing from Representative Harker and Representative Roland and others that may have concerns. One thing I can talk about is the impact of OUS budgets the last 19 years and the impact on our membership and as well as the student population. And any opportunities to really maximize return on investment benefits for the post-secondary system, you will find us here testifying in favor of those and supporting that. This was priority legislation in 2007 for higher education advocates, and we just wanted to add our strong seal of approval this legislative session, and we really hope we can get this bill this session. And thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Melissa.
Thank you very much, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Melissa Unger, and I represent the Service Employees International Union, Local 503, and we represent over 3,500 members who are the classified staff at the 7 universities in Oregon. And I also am here to urge passage of House Bill 2208. We were a part of the coalition that has worked on this for the last, I think this is the third time it's come up, and the reason that we're supportive is we actually represent those employees who provide those student services, and while it might not be a net gain right now, the long-term impact is critical. We've seen over years of budget declines and, tuition increases that student services are often a place to get cut first, and our members are the frontline workers who are providing those services and have seen their workloads increase and deal with the students who are trying to figure out how to make sure that they get that financial aid check or get the class they need or the academic counseling. And so, making sure that providing this and having the long-term net gain go to student services is critical for our members on these campuses, and that's why we're here supporting this bill and urge you to pass it.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Green, I wondered if you'd come back, please. Encore. I understand that there may be an amendment that OUS has requested, and I wondered if you could talk us through that amendment request.
We're talking about that just now, and I'd forgotten to mention that to you. Apologize. Do I need to reintroduce myself?
Yes, please.
Okay. For the record, my name is Mike Green, Associate Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration, Oregon University System. After this bill was drafted, our bond counsel was reviewing it and found that some of our accounts that are established to be general fund matching accounts for capital projects where we issue Article 11G bonds for them that require match, those accounts were established in statute to be part of the general fund. The original bill removed them from the general fund. The amendments to the bill basically put them back in the general fund because they need to be in the general fund in order for them to be constitutionally qualified as a match. So, and there is one other amendment in there that was a catch that we had referred to the wrong fund, and it just would have, it's a kind of a housekeeping catch, but it would have created a problem for us. But basically, the amendments are to do that, to move those existing matching accounts back in the general fund, and also to remove from statute the matching accounts that were created over time that are basically serve their purpose. There's no longer any need for them.
Any questions about the amendment? Great, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Now, we have this bill scheduled potentially for a work session on Friday, if we can get the amendments and the fiscal back in time.
The amendments are printed in front of you.
Oh, the amendments are printed in front of us, so it will be available to us to work on Friday, a small amendment, some light dinner time reading.
this one?
yeah. A bedtime story for your kids. What's your pleasure? Are we ready to work it on Friday?
No, it's much bigger than the bill.
Sure. All right, so we will hear this and work it again on Friday. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Before you close out of this, I do have a question, because although it's almost circular dollars, this is still a question of ultimately it reduces general fund availability. And so I'm wondering, can you tell us, maybe you don't want to tell us now, but your thoughts on how you're going to handle this as we go through this process and there are bills that require money, mm-hmm. and you need to prioritize those. Are you, is it a first come, first served, which I don't think that's the way you would operate, or do you have some rationale for how you're going to ferret out which bills receive priority and which don't?
And I think this one is a little bit different from the others that add new programs, because there is a circular piece in this, and it will go to Ways and Means for them to sort out. However, as the bills are slowly getting referred into our committee, my intention is, we hear bills that have fiscal impacts on them, as we heard the vision screening bill the other day, is to hear them and then hold them till we have everything in, so that we as a committee are able to prioritize what it is that we're sending on to Ways and Means. So it would not be a first come, first serve as we go through on some of these. We'll have public hearings, and then there might be a delay for some time before we bring it back to work it.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question, clarification?
Sure.
When you're talking about working it on Friday, are you talking about a work session on Friday? Because it's too late to post that.
I thought we had this one posted for Friday.
Oh, yes, excuse me. We do.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it did.
Okay.
It did.
Thank you. Okay, so with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2208 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2112. And Roxy, could you give the summary on 2112?
Yes. This is a bill that's designed to solve a problem with the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board. They're currently having problems getting volunteers. It's a 20-member board. They currently have a five members vacancy. And part of the problem is the compensation that's allowed by state statute. If you are a public employer official, you cannot get any compensation for serving on the board. But the maximum allowed by statute to hire a substitute is $25 a day. And so, especially for teachers, it's a problem. This bill would allow compensation to all members of the board up to $250 a day. There are proposed amendments on this bill, and I think that Morgan Allen will be discussing those.
Thank you. And Morgan. And Cindy Hunt.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, and members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and as always, our trustee legal affairs coordinator, Cindy Hunt, is joining me today. But just to give you a little background on House Bill 2112, there was, in 1971, the legislature created the Fair Dismissal Law and established the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board. And essentially what happens, a permanent teacher or administrator dismissed by a school board can appeal that decision to FDAB, the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board, and they essentially hold a hearing on the dismissal. And as your committee administrator said, there's a 20-member board. The Department of Education provides staffing and other resources to the FDAB, and that 20-member board need to have 5 teachers, 5 administrators, 5 school board members, and then 5 members of the public at large that don't work for a school district. So just to give you a little more background, when these appeals are filed, they usually convene panels of 3 FDAB members. They get assigned to the case, and they conduct probably on average, you know, between 2 and 10 hearings a year. They usually last 1 to 3 days. And after the hearing, the FDAB panel, with counsel from the Department of Justice, will issue a written decision on the appeal. One other important thing is these FDAB decisions are appealable to the Court of Appeals. So essentially we have an issue that serving on FDAB is a pretty significant time commitment for folks, and it's important that we have the full complement of 20 people on the board, because when we have vacancies, then you have the same people sort of cycling through these panels over and over again and having to take more time off from their jobs. So historically, FDAB has had difficulty recruiting members and sort of keeping this full roster of folks on the board. Just to kind of give you an example, actually we did have 5 vacancies, but we've been fortunate and we just recently made 2 vacancies, so now we have only 7, now we have 17 out of 20 instead of 15 out of 20, but it sort of goes up and down and people are cycling in and out of it. So the department, since we staff FDAB, we filed this bill on their behalf. Their board took a vote and said this is what we think is a pretty reasonable solution to increase the compensation so that folks could hire substitutes and take time out from work in case they lose compensation. So just to make clear, the bill would allow members to receive compensation up to $250 a day. Currently, the limit is $30. And then it would allow those folks to use that compensation to pay for a substitute. And generally, that would be substitute teachers. Some school districts provide substitutes or allow people to use flex time or leave time to take this, but some districts don't. And so that makes it difficult sometimes to fill some of the teacher slots. So we have a proposed amendment, which we'll get to in a minute. So essentially, the idea is that there's compensation for those folks who don't get compensated at their job, and then for those folks who have to find a replacement at their job, they could use that compensation to cover the costs with their employer. So a couple other things to note, the bill doesn't alter the existing process for expenses, and school districts where the appeals originate, so for example, if the Salem-Keizer School District had an appeal that went to FDAB, then that school district is responsible for paying these expenses and the compensation of that panel's members in that 1 to 3 day period when they're actually hearing the appeal. So again, we requested this. We staff FDAB. We requested on their behalf. Unfortunately, none of the FDAB members could be here today, but their chair, Alfonso Lopez Vasquez, wanted us to share with the board that they, at their most recent annual meeting, they voted in support of this legislation and asked us to come over and work this bill for them. So on the second page of your testimony, actually I had a really good conversation, and we have 2 proposed amendments. One, your committee administrator was very astute. She found an unintended consequence in our draft, and sort of in our conversations, we thought of another one. So we have 2 proposed amendments that we've submitted. The first one is would prevent double compensation. It wasn't our intention that people could, for lack of a better term, double dip. So if your employer paid for you to serve on FDAB, you then could not claim compensation from FDAB, so essentially preventing double dipping. The second thing is we needed a little more clarification on, for example, for teacher members who might have to hire a substitute teacher in their school district, that we needed an amendment to make it very clear that they could use that compensation then to either pay their district, or we could pay their district directly, is I believe what that does. So those are just real technical amendments to sort of avoid unintended consequences, and we're glad that we caught those early enough before it got too far down into the process. So with that, Cindy and I would be happy to answer your questions and take any comments you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Norman?
Madam Chair, thank you. On the teacher paying substitute teacher, would it not be in the best interest of the department simply to ask the school district to submit a request for payment so that there would be no question about what happened to that money? As opposed to paying it to the person who serves on your board, you give that person with the expectation that that person may, in fact, reimburse the school district. Would it not be in everybody's best interest to have the school district submit a bill to the department?
Yeah, Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, Cindy Hunt, Legal Affairs Coordinator for the department, but in this role, I'm actually the administrator for FDAB. FDAB discussed that at their last meeting, and one of the issues was some of the FDAB members felt that because there was only five teacher members, or in some cases three or four, that doing something like that would not treat all of the membership the same, because other members express, well, if a teacher's employer gets paid directly, shouldn't my employer? And so, yeah, so they felt that they didn't want to disrupt the way expenses were reimbursed, but yet they wanted to address the issue of shortages on FDAB, and so that's why they left the expense reimbursement and the compensation reimbursement as nearly as the same as what it is right now.
Thank you.
Representative Huffman.
A few questions, mm-hmm. Madam Chair, if I may, if I can keep track of them. Morgan, I apologize if you covered this in your testimony. Where does this pot of money come from, first of all?
Chair Gelser and Representative Huffman, it comes out of the general fund budget for the superintendent's office at the Department of Education. So we don't get a specific appropriation from the legislature. It's just one of those things that over the years we've picked up, and it's part of our responsibility. So the
board is willing and able to absorb this expense, additional expense?
Yeah, Chair Gelser and Representative Huffman, we have prepared a fiscal impact statement, and the maximum fiscal impact on the Department of Education for the next biennium is about $10,000, assuming that you had the maximum number of meetings and every single member claimed the $250, it would be about $10,000.
Follow-up, why 250? What was the math that went into deciding 250?
I'm going to let my colleague take a shot at that one.
Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, that is the number that FDAB came up with, and I believe they didn't want to appear to be too greedy, so they did not pick a higher number, but they wanted a number that was more reasonable. And so I don't think I have a direct answer for you about that. But
a follow-up on that would be, and maybe you kind of answered that in a way, but is there a precedent with other boards or commissions and compensation that this 250 was derived from? And you probably answered that they came up with it themselves, but I'd be interested to know if there are other boards or commissions that are comparable or... I know some are not paid at all.
Right. Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, no, there aren't any other boards that I'm aware of that have this kind of compensation, but FDAB is also kind of unique from other boards. And the reason I say that is because they specifically get appeals from school districts, so they don't necessarily control the numbers of meetings they have because they're reacting to the school districts. So the other part of FDAB that's very different from other boards is if the appeal comes and it's because of a teacher dismissal, a teacher member of the board has to sit on the panel. So that's why when there are few teacher members on the panel, those teacher members start serving double, triple, duty. And other boards and commissions, they control the numbers of meetings that they have. They don't necessarily have to come to a board meeting like the FDAB members do. So there's some big differences, I think, with FDAB and some of these other boards.
One final.
Sure.
What do you guys think about public perception if this is passed on at a time when we're talking about struggling financially and holding pre-K-12 harmless as much as possible? Are we going to be viewed as irresponsible? Mm-hmm. Do you mind if I point back at you guys?
Absolutely.
Morgan did it.
Chair Gelser and Representative Huffman, I think I would respond that we would not be here with this bill today if we felt it were fiscally irresponsible. But to give you a little bit more detail, you know, again, for the department, the maximum fiscal, additional fiscal is about $10,000 a biennium, sort of assuming maximum claims and maximum meetings and things like that. So it's a relatively small amount of money that we feel like we could absorb, and we have been responsible for these folks for a long time and sort of feel it's our duty to do that. As far as the other thing, it would slightly increase costs for school districts. So the maximum compensation right now a member serving on one of those panels would get would be $30, and that's paid by the school district. So it would slightly increase some costs for school districts that actually have these appeals. So again, it's only the school districts that have the appeals. But I think if, you know, I didn't see any of the COSA or OSBA people signed up to testify to this, but I think what they would probably tell you is that this is a very cost-effective means for them to resolve a lot of these disputes. It saves them a lot of money from getting things into the court system, attorney fees and things like that. They can go to the board, and for as little as a few hundred dollars to maybe $2,000 or so, they could settle an employment dispute. So I think it's a very fiscally responsible thing, you know, relative to some of the other procedures and court costs that you could incur in these types of situations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Huffman. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to confess my, prior knowledge here. I was an FDAB member until less than a year ago, and I've been a part of those conversations for multiple annual meetings. Multiple. And I'll keep it to questions. I'll try very hard to keep it to questions. On page 2, and you just talked about this, Morgan, a little bit, lines 22 and 23. Compensation and expenses paid as provided in this subsection shall be paid by the district school board from which the appeal is taken. That's new, correct?
Chair Gelser and Representative Springer, no, that's not new. That's currently part of the statute. If you look up to roughly lines 9 through 15, I believe it says on line 11 to be paid by the school district board. So they're currently responsible for paying those expenses and compensation. The change would be that it could go from a maximum of $30 for compensation to a maximum of $250.
Okay.
So other expenses are provided in statute. So the I don't believe anything changes with expenses. It would just be that potential. And I think in our fiscal impact statement we've issued, you know, we estimated for school districts, if you had a one-day panel, it would add another potentially $660 per day. If you had a three-member panel meeting from one day, instead of $90, it would cost now $750, potentially. And that all depends, you know, you have to assume that would be the assumption that all three members are not getting compensated by their employer, don't have some sort of agreement with their employer where they can use vacation time or their employer covers their service on here. So that kind of a long-winded answer to your question. But that's the little change.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. It sure looked like I had more, didn't it? And I probably do.
Well, we can come back to you. Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Morgan, and probably more Cindy. In terms of the kind of mechanics of how this would work, for those teachers who are involved and who would require substitutes, I mean, those substitutes will have to be hired by the district, right? And in many cases, most cases, through a collective bargaining agreement, right? And for liability reasons, the teacher just can't go out and hire somebody to take their place.
Chair Gelser, Representative Dembro, you're correct. Yes, it's the school district employees. The individual FDAB members are not hiring their own substitutes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the school then would, this kind of goes back to Representative Van Orman's question, the school district would assess the cost of the substitute and then would notify FDAP and FDAP. How exactly is this going to work?
Chair Gelser, Representative Dembro, it would happen in multiple ways. So currently, the way the bill is, it says up to $250 as established by rule of FDAB. So as soon as this was passed, FDAB would adopt rules to put processes in place on how to calculate up to $250. And they're very much interested in not going to $250. It's up to for a reason. And so what would happen is they would look at things like, you know, does the member get compensation? Does the school district require the member to turn over the compensation to pay for a substitute? How much is the substitute? That kind of thing. But the money would go to the member, who would then, according to their employment agreement or their collective bargaining agreement, would then turn it over to the school district, depending on that agreement. But it could vary depending on, you know, from one FDAP member to the next, as far as what their arrangement is with their particular employer.
Has there been, you know, a calculation as to the actual cost of substitutes for a full day? Would this pretty much come in under budget, or is it still going to require some loss in pay?
Chair Gelson, Representative Dembro, I looked to a couple of your members on the panel. I believe the average cost of a substitute, I want to say, is $150 a day, roughly, for a school district. It's actually calculated by us in another statute, and that's a whole other subject. We'll have another bill related to that later.
Great. Okay. So there's some room to grow, then, mm-hmm. with this $250 limit.
Yeah. And Chair Gelser, Representative Dembro, one of the things I want to emphasize and make clear is in all of FDAB's discussions on this bill at their October meeting, all of those discussions centered around not going up to the $250 amount. They wanted to be very fiscally responsible about this.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dembro. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. I'm new to this world, have never served on any of these boards, but on another committee that I participate in, the Healthcare Committee, we're talking about boards of various types. And this board differs from that, or the proposal here differs from those boards as we're considering them in a couple of ways. One, it's very large, very much larger than any of the other ones we're dealing with, and thus automatically has higher costs and perhaps more challenges in terms of pulling people together, keeping them on for a four-year term, etc. And also, what we're considering there is tying the compensation for board members to the per diem that's issued. There's a federal national per diem that is currently at $100 or $109, and it's less than half of what's being proposed here. And while I accept what you're saying about this not being fiscally irresponsible under most conditions, we're not there anymore, right? This is a time where we're going to struggle to protect and keep pre-K through 12 harmless, hold them harmless in these budgetary constraints. I don't think this will fly very well in some cases, even though the dollar amount is not large. You are talking about going, I can see the headlines, from $30 up to $250. I'm concerned about it for that reason. And I guess a question is, does the board need to be that large? If I'm counting correctly, it's 20 members.
Yeah, Chair Gelser and Representative Harker, the composition of the board is set in statute. It's in ORS 342-930 that it needs to be 20 members. They're appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And I don't know if you have anything to add.
Yeah, another piece of the board is that of the five teacher members, they come from different sizes of school districts. Mm-hmm. So it's even more precise than our broad overview that we've laid out here. And so, yeah, it's by statute specifically that it's 20 members distributed amongst these four groups and then further distributed according to size.
I'm sure.
All right, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I think Representative Harker asked my question. So.
All right. We'll remember that for next time. Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Morgan, just did you say that the superintendent is currently incurring these costs through her administrative office?
Yes, I could double-check that for sure, but my understanding is it's general fund through the superintendent's office, Representative Kopp.
Yes, I can confirm that. It's through the superintendent's office, and that's also by statute. By statute, the superintendent is charged with basically designated someone to staff the board and also to pay the attorney general's fees that are associated with the board.
So then the follow-up, mm-hmm. for clarification, so the additional funds that are being suggested or recommended in this bill would not offset any of those funds that are currently that the superintendent's having to expend.
And Chair Gelser and Representative Kopp, I don't believe so.
Okay.
And Chair Gelser, I might make a suggestion. I think your committee has asked some very good questions, and we're sort of the proxy for this group. We're, okay. we're doing this. And, we try to be very customer service oriented. So
and you're doing this very well.
So what I might suggest is, if you'd like, what we could do is Cindy and I could sort of share some of the concerns that we've heard from several members of your committee on this proposal and sort of explain, given the extraordinary circumstances that we're facing, if they would be willing to consider some amendments perhaps to change some of the dollar amount suggested in the thing. Because what I'm hearing is that we might have trouble sailing down the river. So.
Was that subtle? And I think that's true. This is not currently scheduled for a work session as per the discussion that we had a couple of minutes ago. Given that Morgan will go back to the group that's proposed this bill, are there further questions to add on that you want to go back? Yes, there are. So I've got a bunch of people on the queue, so I'm going to come to you as it's your turn. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I just want to go back to the size of the panel and perhaps you or the committee, and you could clarify. The committee doesn't meet as an entire body regularly, right? There are selected panels that meet. So it's not, it's different, I think, from those licensing boards. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, perhaps Vice Chair Springer can speak to her experiences. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many days a year did you have to give up in your experience as an FDAP member?
Oh, I'd love to answer that question. I'm trying to couch my questions so they're useful and germane to the conversation we're having here and not reflecting back over years of conversations here. There is about a two-hour meeting once a year, the annual meeting. That is the only meeting of the body collectively. And I would get it. Okay. Stay on task. So there's that meeting. Mm-hmm. And then...
And that might be an evening meeting, or...
No, that's the first Monday of every October from 9 to 11. And usually over at 10:30. And usually over at 10:30. And then, and you might correct me, but I believe that's accurate. And then the bulk of the work of that board is to meet and hear these appeals. That's the only time we come together. So I served on one particular case, which was protracted, 3 days at one part of the appeal, and then I think another day and a half. And it was a rather lengthy one in 06. And if
please, if I could speak to
the makeup of the board, not defending it in any way, shape, or form, because when I first got on there, I thought, what a large board. But when you need to have a hearing... And it's usually at an ESD in the area. When you need to have a hearing, it is hard to pull the three members that need to be strategically chosen based on who the appeal is about to come together and sacrifice 100 miles or 200 miles or whatever, a three-day block. So that's why they have that, is so there's some choices there. Because I've been called and said, so-and-so said they couldn't, and so-and-so said they couldn't, and can you? So there, I'll keep it to that. Did that answer your question? Or address that.
Right. So again, it's not many, many multiple meetings that everybody on the board is involved with.
So out of 3 or 4 years, I always had that two-hour meeting. Right. Each year, 1 year, I probably had 5.5 days. I think that was it.
Representative Huffman.
I'll be quick. Two comments and a question. Morgan, we understand, and no intention of shooting the messengers, so you guys are safe. I'm not like Olson. I'm not packing, so you're okay. For my part, I'm not going to speak for the whole committee, but if you could convey that my questions are, I'm not attacking the committee, and I certainly appreciate the work they do, and I'm not insinuating otherwise, okay? And pardon me, I'm a little on the simple side this afternoon. We've talked twice about the money coming out of the Department General Fund. So help me figure out what portion of that on page 2 and line 23 comes out of the district. Does the district reimburse the department?
Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, What happens is, in fact, we just had a panel meeting 2 weeks ago. So, and what happens is that the three panel members submit their expense report to the department. And so then the department reimburses them right away. And then what happens is that the department then collects those three, you know, expense reports, and then we submit a bill to the school district where the appeal came from. The expense of the panel that doesn't go to the district is the Attorney General's fees. That is paid for by the Department of Education. The other expense of the panel that the department pays for is the one meeting a year that Representative Springer referred to in October. That is paid for completely by the Department of Education. It's not billed to any school districts. So that's where the fiscal impact of the bill comes from, is that one annual meeting a year.
So, Madam Chair, so there is a possibility, albeit small because I haven't seen Chuck flailing back there, but this could be, maybe, an unfunded mandate on the district, considering, although, that it could be a real bargain for the district because of the type of negotiations that are working.
Chair Gelser, Representative Huffman, another thing to emphasize is some of the districts, through binding arbitration and other dispute resolution practices, don't even come to FDAB. It's kind of their choice. But be that as it may, most of the time we don't get an appeal from the same district in the same biennium. It's kind of spread around. You know, so you might have a district this year and then another district the next year and that kind of thing. So it really kind of varies.
Thank you.
And Chair Gelser, one comment I'd add to what Cindy said, Representative Huffman, I would look at it more as a fee for service. If a district,
it's their choice.
It's an unfunded service, but it's there and available, and if they choose to use it or decide that's the best way to go, then they pay for it.
Their choice. Good point.
Thanks. And before we move on to the next series of questions, is there anyone else in the room, having heard the discussion, that might be interested in joining this discussion? I don't see anyone. Okay, Rustin Roblin.
Yeah, I guess I want to, from my perspective, having looked at this bill, I want to state that this is not a per diem issue. It's nothing like any other committee. I mean, this is a tribunal or a trial group that keeps districts out of court, and they choose to make it. And the people who sit there on the court shouldn't have to have expenses because they choose to give up their time to help solve these other people's problems. And so what we're saying is the expenses they incur when they go to do that should be paid by somebody, and it should be the people who want to have the hearing. I mean, that's who should pay for it. And so from my perspective, it shouldn't be get confused in per diems, because the only real per diem issue is the one general meeting where they ask everybody to come to have a general meeting, and that's paid for by the department. So from my perspective, I think you keep it out of per diem, because per diem is to say it's cost you more money to go live there because you're going to do something. We're going to give this extra money to cover those extra costs. This is saying you coming means you didn't get to do your job, therefore you weren't paid for that day. We need you, so we're going to pay you your expenses, as opposed to paying the expenses of lawyers and others, who oftentimes are more expensive than the people who are coming here, who have a general interest in the discussion because they are in the same profession, and hopefully the information they can give to the board or the decision they make will be one that the board understands because they are practitioners. Is that kind of a statement? I mean, that's why I don't compare this in the same as per diem.
Thank you, Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, my question has been answered.
Thank you. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It says up to $250 a day. So that implies to me that it's a range. And how do you determine exactly what somebody would get if they served on this board?
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, the bill also directs FDAB to adopt rules around that. So the short answer to your question is by rule it would be determined. But the kinds of things that FDAB has discussed as a basis for that determination are things like whether or not the member was compensated by their employer. As an example, we have one member, a non-affiliated member who serves on the board right now, who works for the Oregon University system, and so his employer pays his salary on that day. He has indicated he would not seek any compensation. So that would be one of the factors, for example.
Okay.
But as far as the other factors go, FDAB hasn't had a full They don't have draft administrative rules or anything like that at this time yet.
Follow up?
Yes.
So what this means then is that $250, if we pass this bill, $250 would be the max that you would give.
Correct.
Thank you.
Correct.
Thank you. And Representative Springer.
Can I make a statement, not a question?
Sure.
Of course. And don't constrain yourself.
Is it obvious?
One thing I did want to clarify, not to pull out and focus on disagreements here, but this is not the end of the process. If somebody comes to an FDAB hearing, I don't want to leave the impression that's the end of the process, and so it saves an incredible amount of money. There is an appeal process after that to the Court of Appeals, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so people don't like the FDAB decision. They can go on. So I just want to be careful that we're not thinking this is one of the best cost-saving measures we have. It's just another step in the process.
That's correct. Many of FDAB decisions are appealed to the Court of Appeals, just like a circuit court decision or something like that. The other thing I think that's worth mentioning is the FDAB member sits on the panel, so there's the day when they're hearing the testimony, but then the Attorney General goes back and drafts up an order and then sends that to the panel members for review. And that process, I think, can take some time as well while they're sitting at their homes and that kind of thing. But they definitely have some very serious responsibilities, you know, in reviewing those orders and, you know, agreeing and voting on them and that kind of thing.
One more quick thing?
Yeah.
When this conversation started a few years ago, it was really based around struggling to keep teachers on this. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole crux of this issue. They couldn't keep teachers on because school districts are saying that's a sub-expense, and there was lots of conversation about I take time off from work and take a personal day or vacation day or whatever, and that really is where a lot of this stems, whether that's good or bad. And I know the conversation, the one I was particularly fond of, was school districts should just simply be given compensated for the sub fee, and people have that opportunity to take that day or not. So anyway, I think I'm really done.
Thank you, Representative Springer. Representative Dembrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for that at-home review, pondering, research, whatever, what is the compensation rate for that?
Chair Gelser, Representative Dembrough, it is zero.
Right. And so I just want to echo Representative Roblin's points about the self-sacrifice that people are making to serve on these panels and just how important it is, how necessary.
Any further questions for this panel? So, Morgan, you'll go back to the group and talk with them about some of the ideas that have been raised here today.
We'll share our experiences with your committee.
And encourage them to come, too. This is the most fun committee in the building to come before, I understand. So thank you very much. Is there anyone else that would like to testify to this bill today?
I would think not.
Any
Morgan, please don't mention my name.
any further comments, discussion for the record from the committee?
Yeah. Normally, I'm quiet. And hardly ever say anything. So.
That's why we scheduled this bill. We were pulling you out. All right, thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2112. And we're going to stand at ease for about 5 minutes while we get the Legislative Council here for our discussion on our other two bills. So the committee is at ease.
Well, and the other part of it.
Okay, so the Committee on Ed will come back to order. We're still waiting for Hannah, as in Hannah from Legislative Council, not Bruce Hannah, to come. We could invite Representative Hannah, too. But we have also on our agenda the possible introduction of committee bills, and we have one, so maybe we can get that out of the way before we move forward. So there should be an LC at your spot. It's the very last thing. I know that I've talked to my staff here. So again, as we do on each of these, the reminder that when we introduce a committee bill, it's a formality. It does not indicate the support or opposition of any person to the actual bill. It's the process of putting it into the process, and though individuals may affirm putting this into the queue, that certainly does not commit anyone's vote, either here in the committee or on the floor. And we have one. Yes.
Oh, go ahead. Finish your sentence.
Okay, we have... I'm so used to at home, nobody wants me to finish my sentence. I've just given up and passed the cookie over. So today we only have one in front of us, and that's LC 1924 that's dated 2209. So Representative Kopp.
Thank you. And the clarification is, it, and I understand all the variables that we can or choose how to support as things proceed, but is it in the intent of the chair that each of these bills will be heard in committee, though?
It is the intent that all of these would come and be assigned to our committee, and then we'd consider the hearing. Some of these are coming from other members and different places to get them in the process. They haven't all been carefully studied, vetted,
right,
et cetera.
I understand that, but that there is a plan that...
There's a high likelihood that these would be heard in committee. Yes.
That's the clarification.
Does that work?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, Madam
yes.
Chair, they may not be assigned to this committee.
Correct. Correct. They may not.
They could go.
That's a very helpful clarification, too.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Great. All right. So, Representative Denbrough, do you have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to move. I move that LC 1924, which is dated 2209, be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you. Are there any objections to the motion? Representative Denbrough moves that LC 1924, dated 2209, be introduced as a committee bill.
Discussion, Madam Chair?
Yes.
So what's the point, I guess, is my question, and I'm asking for clarification of the process because I'm fairly new, but does our decision bind another committee or something, or can't we just speak for what we're going to hear?
Right. What this simply does is it's the magic wand that transforms the LC into a House bill, which then gets printed and comes to us for first reading on the floor and goes to the Speaker's office, who decides where to send it. It just puts it in the first piece of the process by turning it into a bill. Yes. Mr. Representative Roblin.
I was going to try to explain a little bit too. It is a different way of getting a bill introduced rather than having your name on it. So at the end of the day, when this bill gets introduced, it will not have by Representative Hoffman or Roblin. It'll say pursuant by the Speaker, pursuant to the House Education Committee, it was introduced as a bill.
Okay.
So the only difference is the heading up there as to who introduced it, and there are a lot of reasons why people may wish that it was introduced as a bill here in a committee as opposed to it being introduced by an individual member. And that's really the only difference that you'll see.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Are there any other questions, comments? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection.
Wait a minute.
Oh, Representative Van Orman.
Representative Van Orman is having a hard time with this one. And it's not because I'm not concerned about what children are doing to children. But I think the biggest complaint I have from the school districts are this continual record keeping and reporting and the amount of time that's required. And then in it says you're non-standard if you don't follow these requirements. I'm having a hard time with those pieces.
And that's why, again, going back to the clarification at the beginning, we're not passing the bill.
That's
we're having
right.
The bill.
I know, and that's why I'm even having a hard time passing it on.
All right. So maybe let's call the roll on this one, please, if that's okay.
Agreeing that we're going to hear it, right?
Representative Harker?
No, it may go to a different committee.
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Combs?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Excuse.
Representative Roland?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Representative Van Orman?
No.
Vice Chair Denbrough?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Gelser?
Aye. So I think carrying the necessary majority, it is introduced as a committee bill. And so I close the work session for the introduction of committee measures.
No, that was for saying it's passed. And then gavel it. Go out of the meeting. You should always gavel.
Oh, I should gavel twice. Great. Thank you. So.
So you get to do it one more time. For the record.
For the record, we're now closing the work session on the introduction of committee bills. Thank you, Representative Roblin. And now, we are going to open our work session on House Bill 2062. And we have Hannah from the Legislative Council. And at your places, you should have a dash 3 amendment and a dash 5 amendment. And Hannah is going to talk to us a little bit about what each of these amendments does.
I am Hannah Lai from Legislative Council. The Dash 3 and Dash 5 amendments go through and change some places throughout this House bill to talk about substantiated claims. That was a concern, is that documents that or claims that had not been substantiated would still be available for release. And now we're saying it has to be substantiated. So that's the language that we're getting for the most part for these amendments. So I'm sure there's probably more questions you have.
Thank you. And can you also talk a little bit about the letter that you sent? The dash 3 is the language where you took out the liability, the reference to removing liability from the district. Could you talk a little bit about that issue and what that does in the dash 3 amendment?
Okay.
Please.
Currently in House Bill 2062, what we have is some provisions that say if some information is released, we're going to provide some civil immunity to a school district or an employee who releases that information. And what has happened is that recently there's been some court cases that has raised some concern in our office about what the effect of these sort of provisions do. And the concern is that maybe these provisions no longer really are effective, that we cannot protect people from liability in a way that we thought that we could before. This is all extremely new. It's basically only came up in our office about 2 weeks ago, and we're still trying to figure out what exactly the best solution is for handling this sort of situation to provide some protection for liability for these public employees. Right now, we really don't have the answer. Like I said, it's very, very new. We're still trying to figure out exactly where we are going for it. So this does what I wrote the letter about, was to say that this is a concern. It's on the horizon, but just to say there are lots of other statutes that have that out there, so it's not like this is an odd problem, and this is going to be something very important that the legislature will be having to look at probably later on in the session, but just to say we have identified this, we think it is an issue, you may not be able to get the protection you thought you were going to get.
Thank you. And to follow up, this, because it takes that language of the liability out, mm-hmm. that places this issue back under the tort claim
Correct.
Limit, the tort claim protection.
Yes. By not having this language in here, we're fairly certain that we would default back to the Oregon Tort Claims Act, which does provide some protections for public employees. It says that the employee cannot be brought in a lawsuit. It would be the public body, so the school district in most situations. And there is a limit. I have the numbers in the letter, which I don't have in front of me right now, $500,000, I think, for the total claim, $50,000 is somewhere in there as well. So there are some limitations with that. yeah, the concern is if we have, if we keep this liability language in the bill, those caps may just be out, and so it would be pretty much sky's the limit. But again, we're still trying to figure that out. We're working on it, and we don't really have a definite solution at this point.
And could you tell me again how many kinds of statutes that this impacts in terms of existing law?
Madam Chair, I do not know the answer to that. It would be mostly the sort of protections that were provided before the Oregon Constitution went into effect, so mostly anything that dealing with defamation. So I have no idea what that would be, but there's quite a few. There's quite a few from even this session. So it's not just, you know, the random four or five bills. I couldn't guess, but maybe 100. I don't know. There's going to be a lot.
And then could you talk a little bit, when we met to talk about this earlier this week, in terms of the liability, what that tie back to the release of only substantiated information does to a defamation claim?
Okay. The main, with the defamation claim, affirmative defense to a defamation claim is that the claim was true. So you would not have a problem of a school district saying that this employee is a bad teacher if the school district has been able to come back and say, yes, it really is a bad teacher. The problem would be if the school teacher were to come back and say, no, I've always been a good school teacher. You can't prove I'm a bad school teacher. So that is one of the protections in this sort of situation, is that if the school district or the employee can prove that the school teacher did the things that they said that they did, then there would be protection from a defamation claim.
And so, kind of taking it out of the broad language of good and bad, and into the, because I think most teachers are extraordinarily good teachers. We're very lucky in the state of Oregon to have some of the best teachers anywhere in the country, who certainly work under conditions that are very difficult and look at budgets being cut twice in 7 years in the middle of the school year, and still do a great job for our kids. If you're looking, though, at a teacher for whom there's been a substantiated allegation of sexual misconduct, which is that rare circumstance that we're contemplating in this bill, and the bill under these Dash 3 amendments requires that what's released is that substantiated allegation of misconduct, would this not, with this amendment and removing that liability, wouldn't that put greater weight of responsibility on the school district to ensure that what they are releasing are only those substantiated claims, because they would be protected as long as they were substantiated, and to further assure that what's not being released are, you know, whispers in the hallway or kind of scurrilous claims that are left sitting in a personnel record someplace?
Correct, Madam Chair. I think you are correct with that. Is that, yeah, substantiated claim most likely would be true, and that is what gives you the protection for the defamation claim.
Great, thank you. Are there questions, Representative Huffman?
Hannah, I don't want to assume anything. Now, I can assume what substantiated means, but is there a definition in statute? What are we talking about? And I'm not trying to nitpick, but may and shall, you know, we've discussed that a lot over the years. Do we have a definition for substantiated that gives a school district guidance on what information would be allowable?
And Chair Representative Huffman, there is not one in statute. It's usually based on case law. I can look and see what some other courts have provided in guidance for that. But substantiated would be, you know, pretty close to proving it as true. It probably is a little lower standard than all and out finding it being true, but I'd say it's a very high standard.
I guess I'm a little, and like I say, I can assume I have my definition of substantiated, but I am concerned that we nail down that piece.
Thank you, Representative Huffman. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. What is the liability exposure now? What is the situation with liability now?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I do not have that letter in front of me right now, but it would be the Oregon Tort Claims Act, and I believe it's $500,000 for a single act. I want to say $50,000 for other damages. I don't know right off, but I can look that up for you and provide that to you.
Madam Chair, just follow up.
Yes.
What I meant is if this bill didn't pass, that's where, if somebody were to reveal to another school district that
XYZ teacher is a bad teacher, there was a substantiated claim, what is the exposure now for liability? Would it be, is that what you're saying? It would fall under the Oregon Tort Claims Act now anyway? So it's not a change, really?
Correct.
Got it.
Yeah, I think so. Thank you. Representative Roblin.
No,
you weren't in the queue. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to Representative Huffman's questions about substantiated. I do think that that's something that we need to get clarified, you know, either in the bill or, you know, certainly among ourselves. I think we had been talking about a fairly high bar for substantiation, that there would have to be a formal process, an investigation, perhaps through TSPC. We were talking about something pretty serious, and I am concerned that substantiated, I mean, taken out of context, could mean just, you know, that there was an investigation by the immediate supervisor, and the supervisor is satisfied. So, you know, I'm just wondering, Hannah, if you have any advice for us. Do you think that we need to nail this down a little more? That would be my inclination at this point.
Yes, Representative Gelser, Representative Dimbrough, nailing it down as much as you can always helps. Some of your suggestions of saying that there has to be an investigative process and setting up the process would definitely help. Unfortunately, to some extent, it will always be a matter of fact. You know, what do the people investigating it, what do they think, what were their impressions by interacting with the people involved? And there's always going to be a human element in that you will never be able to completely define. But setting up the process probably is the best way to try and get there, to make certain that, you know, one school district doesn't do a very thorough process where the other one just does a 20-minute conversation or whatever. Maybe provide them some guidelines as to what is an appropriate process.
And can I ask Vicki Chamberlain to, would you mind coming up to the dais too?
You're not getting heated up.
Could you talk a little bit about what substantiation means under the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. I'm scrambling mentally back here while you're talking. Substantiation, at least in so far as the commission taking action, could come from a number of places. It could come from a witness who wasn't engaged in the conduct, but who maybe had witnessed the conduct. It could come from the victim. It could come from an admission from the educator. But it would have to be enough evidence that you could produce in a hearing to prove if you were suggesting that someone had engaged in misconduct. So it has to rise to the level of some kind of credible evidence. And it's an important point. If the commission doesn't have any credible evidence, like what I just gave you, it would be very difficult for them to act. Even though you really think it happened, you really have to find the evidence.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair.
I just jumped through my thing.
Am I out of turn?
Yes, and that's my fault.
Go right ahead.
Can you hold for a minute? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair, Madam Chair. I'm sitting here thinking about substantiation, and it appears that what we're really talking about is people who have not been charged with a criminal act or convicted of a criminal act. Is that correct?
Yes, we would say yes.
Thank you.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that's kind of where I was headed, because, and I'm glad we're having this discussion, because initially when I was reading this, I was kind of defining substantiated as situations where action was taken. But I'm kind of hearing that maybe that's not the case. It's a reliable rumor, maybe, that somebody was, we're almost sure that they were involved in a sexual abuse claim or something. Do you see where I'm coming from?
I do, and
we've been working on this issue in another agency around, and I think it gets very confusing when you're talking about substantiation in a licensing type of an agency in this situation as opposed to a criminal conviction. So that's the first piece that is a different standard. But for you, if I'm understanding correctly, teacher standards and practices, and the way that I had read this bill and the references to substantiation, they pointed to a substantiated allegation as investigated through the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. When you substantiate, don't you have to have evidence so that if you go in front of an administrative law judge or another place that that's upheld? There's an appeal right there, and you have the burden of demonstrating that a reasonable person would find the evidence sufficient to demonstrate that the abuse occurred.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. It has everything to do with whether the commission will charge, is whether the commission can prove the charge in a credible way. And that's what ALJs are for. They weigh our evidence. I just also wanted to point out that investigations vindicate people. So, there's two sides to that issue, including our investigation. And the other thing is that often, I think one of the positions districts are put in here is completing investigations. And so you have a statute that requires them to put them on administrative leave if they suspect an investigation. An incident at least around child abuse. And then DHS starts investigating. Law enforcement starts investigating. They actually get pretty upset if the district continues to investigate because you can taint the other investigations. And so I just have been trying to think how you would thread through this loop. It should be substantiated somewhere. We have had in our agency letters from law enforcement saying we can't prove a criminal offense, but we have sufficient evidence that we think the licensure agency ought to look because ours is just the civil level, the substantial.
Thank you. Representative Huffman, do you want to continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we have substantiated a teacher has had an investigation into their background because there was suspicion, and if the investigation didn't turn up anything, would that information be conveyed that, well, there had been an investigation into some accusations?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, I don't know if that's a question. I just thought of another probably alley a district could get down, and that is having to make a decision if and this happens to us, I guess, let me go this way and then I'll come this way. Maybe substantiated is a finding by the commission or DHS or law enforcement, because I think where districts are uneasy is making their own finding. Mm-hmm. And what I could see easily happening is you may get a victim come in and talk to an administrator and disclose some conduct, and then the victim may change his or her mind about talking about it later, which really then is it substantiated. See, so that happens to us where we will have a victim initially talk to us and then they would not go to a hearing. So I'm starting to see a lot of sort of dead ends where people could get with this. We charge and take action when we can prove the conduct. And sometimes that becomes a battle, but it takes credible evidence.
Just a minute. So coming back to your question for a minute, so for Hannah, am I correct that in the -3 amendments, in terms of what would be disclosed to a future employer, it would only be substantiated allegations? So the fact that there ever even was a suspicion or an investigation is not something that would be released to a future employer?
That's correct, Madam Chair. It's only substantiated claims.
Does that get to the question that you're asking?
Yes, although we have had quite a bit of discussion since I brought it up on what substantiated
right.
is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Correct.
So I'm still a little nervous on that.
Okay. Representative Dimbrough.
Again, just following up on that, if substantiated means probable cause for an investigation, I don't think that's strong enough, right? I mean, we're looking for something that has... has led to an investigation. An investigation has happened, and and we're talking potentially about something internal or within the licensure, you know, agency, not necessarily a criminal charge, but where the process, whatever it is, has been followed, and then if it turns out not to have been confirmed, then the fact that there had been an investigation would be expunged then, I think, is what we had talked about. So again, you know, really that notion of substantiated, I think, is really at the crux.
Do you think, and so this is a question for everyone, and I'm hearing this concern and seeing that there's not a point back to the substantiation. If we had an amendment that clarified that substantiation would be substantiation by the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, law enforcement, or the Department of Human Services, would that make it very clear that it's not just a district that's doing that, but it's through these formal processes, all of which have to meet a standard that can be upheld in front of an ALJ with an appeal process? To it.
That's where I'm headed.
Is that where you're? Is that could we get an amendment like that?
Okay.
We've got Representative Roblin, and then we'll come
okay,
to Representative
Roblin. Okay. Yeah.
I guess what I would ask is, if the charge was substantiated, would they have a license?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I was just sort of thinking about that. It's very rare that a district would continue to employ somebody when the district had substantiated the claim. Is the experience that I found. And you'll find that occasionally. If the claim is substantiated, it depends on what the claim is. They could be suspended or they could be reprimanded. If it is actual abuse, that would be unlikely. It was most likely to be a revocation. But you talk about processes. It takes my investigators several months to complete some of these very complex investigations, and then we have to wind it through the process. And that's been sort of the heart of some of the bills that have been in front of you. Maybe the very quickest that the commission could take a license away would be 6 months. But districts, like I said, it's been my experience that if there's a substantiated claim, the district usually is able to take employment action. And does that answer your question?
Yes, Representative Roblin.
Well, the question is, I think one of the issues that brought this to light has to do with, I substantiate a claim. It appears that the employee now decides to sit down with the district with their attorneys, and they come up with an agreement that, okay, I'm going to leave or I'm going to do this, and please don't talk about it. Now, the district has a choice at that point to say, no, we won't take that. But that's where the crux of the problem is that we're looking at trying to get a hold of, is that there are times when they've decided in the best interest of the district and others that person resigns and it goes away. And substantiated or not, it's not a part of that record. And that's a concern, I mean, that people have, that somebody who has done something, but we haven't really got to the crux of it, goes someplace else. And so I just, getting this definition of substantiated and all that kind of stuff is really important if we're actually going to have this bill have any value.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In thinking in light of everything that has been said, and as a former employer of teachers, our standard practice was, if there was a complaint, we looked into it, but we always referred it on to DHS for them to investigate. And we found that was actually good for us, because then DHS had determined that nothing had happened. So then, in what Representative Gelser has said, the question that I have is there an inconsistency amongst the school districts of how they actually approach the problem? In other words, do school districts have a system of investigation that actually is consistent and workable to substantiate, or do we have an inconsistency that's causing us some problems?
Madam Chair and Representative Van Orman, there's 200 and some odd school districts, which means there's 200 and some odd employers with 200 and some odd approaches. And so, they're not a system. They're individual employers. And depending on their resources, it has a whole lot to do with their ability to conduct investigations and quality investigations. So some of the conduct may not rise to the level that requires reporting to DHS or that DHS would even take. So there's quite a long range of conduct here. What we don't want, though, I think, as what Representative Roblin said, is to sweep it under the carpet, and that's we're trying to define how you would keep that out there, that you can't move from district to district just because people don't know what's gone on. And I don't know how you define that, frankly.
Thank you. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And we're dealing with some board issues in the Health Care Committee. And one of the things that came up was that if a licensing in a specific health board was accused of something nefarious and there was an investigation, that they could turn their license in and that would terminate the board's authority to continue the investigation. So my question to you is that, and because we're dealing with it slightly off subject, but when they give up their license, does that terminate your authority to continue an investigation?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, no, it doesn't. In fact, we have an administrative rule that says that even if the educator surrenders their license, we will continue to investigate. And that is because we participate in a national clearinghouse. And we, with the children involved, would want to know whether the conduct could be substantiated. And then the action against the license would be posted for publication for all the rest of the states and territories that participate in that clearinghouse. So folks have tried it. They've tried to negotiate it, but I think that defeats the purpose of what the legislature originally intended my board to do.
Madam Chair, may I follow up?
Yes, you may.
That was the right answer.
You get an A.
No. I guess in this conversation of passing the trash, if you are to the point where you complete the investigation, then the issue is back down at the district level where you never find out about it, and that the district somehow covers it up or hides it and says, go away. So my concern is that if we just rely on TSPC, that we've already got the answer. I mean, you're already doing it. So and it wasn't the issue, if my understanding is TSPC was not doing their job. It was an issue at the district level.
That's correct.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Representative Roblin made a good point that if it was substantiated, the teacher probably would have had their license pulled, and this would be a moot point because they wouldn't be applying for another teaching position or something under the purview of TSPC because they wouldn't have a license to do so they couldn't be hired. But in all of our discussion through the committee meetings this past year, the big effort that we were trying to get at with several of these approaches was to send the strong message to school districts that you cannot make special deals.
Right.
And I just think as a part of that message to give school districts definitions and guidance on, I think substantiated would still be a good thing to explain a little further. But I mean, I like the direction we're headed, and I will say that in several committee meetings this past year, I have said that we want to protect the kids at all costs. I mean, that's our goal. However, I don't want to see any teacher drug through the mud and lose their career when, in fact, they were innocent. We don't want to throw them out first. And we just want to be very cautious on any of these decisions. And I guess that's why I'm kind of being dogged about this and coming back to that definition.
Thank you. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that comment from Representative Huffman. The vulnerability of problem teachers coming from another district is one route we have to be concerned about. Another is coming from another state, and it sounds like that's perhaps partially dealt with through this national registry. The third route is if they're coming from a private school, right, in which case the teachers and standards would have nothing to do with them, or they might have something to do with them. Perhaps you could explain that, Vicki.
Madam Chair, Representative Dimbrough, first on private schools and then out of state. So if they're licensed, we have jurisdiction. If they're not licensed, we don't. It's just that simple, that it's the license that pulls them into our shop, or the charter school registration, or the school nurse certification. That's our universe. Private school teachers are not subject to any of our investigations unless they hold a TSPC license, and about 3,000 private school educators do hold TSPC licenses. On out-of-state, the only protection is somehow the other state agency they came from had knowledge of the conduct. So states all over the nation are grappling with these agreements. We would be less than half a dozen if we move this forward, but they are talking about it. So if the conduct wasn't reported to the agency and the agency didn't take action, we would have no way of knowing. And that's actually, we've had a couple of those cases where there would actually, after the conduct happened here, we found out that there was quite a record of the conduct in another state, and that it was all at the employment level, and it hadn't gone to the state agency, which was really too bad, because then there were two sets of fairly serious victims. That was really bad. May I add something that was in the middle of all this? We have had situations where folks have negotiated to not have their conduct reported to TSPC, and those are hard to discover too, but that defeats the purpose, and it was not sexual misconduct, thank goodness, but we've tried to close that loophole with our rules, but if there's something to negotiate, it may get negotiated.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm choosing to ask, I guess, this rather simplistic question. I just got off the phone, it's been now about 2 hours ago, with one of my superintendents. And he's saying, he's doing a great job tracking what we're doing in this committee, and so I'm thrilled. And he says, I want you to support 2062. And as we've had this conversation now for quite a while, and I came in here and I thought I had my ducks lined up, and I was pretty clear, and I've pored over this a lot and the amendments, and I'm starting to wrestle with the dash 1 and 3 amendments. Are we giving districts a greater or a lesser opportunity in their hiring practices to weed out those teachers that there may be some concerns about and choose those best teachers for their kids in their school?
Madam Chair,
I realize that's a little unfair. I apologize for that.
Well, yeah.
But it's the crux.
I could actually take a dodge if I could. first of all, I'm not the one to ask. I don't hire people in districts. We try to keep our actions as separate from the employment arena as we can, so we can keep it clean. So I think, OSBA and COSA would be the best ones to ask on that one. But I do want to remind you, we license administrators too.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Roblin, who's been waiting a very long time.
I just wanted to say, and I think one of the things that this brings out, for the past number of years, this legislative body has consistently added more tools to your toolbox with respect to how to deal with this. I think we all take it very seriously, and I think as we get closer to getting to the, maybe the crux of some of the other kinds of stuff, it's harder to find places that we have to fix the loophole, because they are there. Example was one you just brought up, and I guess I want to point that out. If a superintendent were involved in one of those secret deals, and it was found out, you can take their license. Is that not correct? If they didn't report something that should have been reported?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I'm sure we could find a way to do that.
So, I think that it is clear, I think, more clear than ever, that administrators understand that they put themselves at risk for covering risky behavior, because it is one of the things that we say we won't do, and we have to report, and failing to report some of those things is punishment. I mean, that it's in the list.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, actually, in terms of the ethical conduct, gross neglect of duty for an administrator is not to report to us.
Correct.
And so that is true.
Representative Kopp?
Thank you. And just for counsel, for clarifying, we've really been talking a lot about teachers here, but is not this bill for any school applicant, whether it's a coach, a custodian, or, I mean, because, yeah, we've just been focusing on teachers. I want to make sure that we that I understand the intent of this bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Com, it applies to any applicant for a position in the school district. So that would be the teacher. That would also be the nighttime janitor. So
thank you.
Full gamut.
And then the follow-up?
Yes.
Because we did spend a lot of time in work group on this. And also the question does come up about the impact, or if there is any impact on any private school, and I'm still not clear about private school inclusion as in part of the definition, or I don't remember where we finished all that piece.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Com, this bill only applies to school districts, so that would only be the public schools. It would not be a private school.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. You talked about national checks a little bit ago, and I was wondering if you are required to do those national checks, and if our school districts are required to, on people who are not licensed with TSBC, such as the people that Representative Comp mentioned.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, it's a clearinghouse for licensure agencies. It's not a clearinghouse for school districts. It's data that we go and acquire regularly, like two and three times a week, so that when an out-of-state applicant applies, we can have current data. It is not our data to own. So that's actually been an issue, is whether school districts could use it. School districts, by law, are not allowed to hire licensed employees until they hold a license. So that they have to come through our door to hire them. So at least as licensed employees go, I don't see a need in Oregon for them to have access, since we handle that up front. One of our bills asks that when we do get that information, if they've been revoked or suspended in another state, that we can move ahead to take immediate action, because we don't have access to the immediate facts. So that was why we had asked for that.
I guess follow-up. I was referring to, obviously, if they're hiring a licensed teacher, they would have to go through TSPC because that's the licensing. But is there a sort of background check available for those who are not licensed, such as the janitors and all that?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher. Right now, all employees of a school district who have direct unsupervised contact with children must be fingerprinted, and we have another bill out there that would say regardless if they have direct unsupervised contact. I just wanted to be clear that the clearinghouse only attracts licensed folks, so that whole group of folks who aren't licensed, there isn't a registry or clearinghouse or a central place for that information. It's two sets of employees.
Thank you. We are going to start losing members. Do you have a quick follow-up to that? Are you? So we're going to hold over the work session on both 2062 and 2063 until Friday. In the meantime, I'm going to ask Representative Dimbro and Representative Huffman to work with me and
Did we open 2063?
We did not open. Do I need to open it to carry it over? Okay. So in a minute, I will open 2063 to carry it over. But I'm going to ask Representative Huffman, Representative Dimbro to work with me and with Hannah and some others on how do we get around this, how do we address this issue of that word substantiation. Clearly, we've got a little bit of work to do on that, and hopefully we'll have something that we can come back to. So I'm closing the public hearing on the work session on House Bill 2062 and holding that over until tomorrow.
Until Friday.
Okay. And I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2063, and I am now closing the work session on House Bill 2063 and carrying it over until Friday.
You got to gavel when you open.
Oh. I'm opening the work session on 2063, and I'm now holding it over until Friday. So I'm now closing the work session on House Bill 2063, and I am closing the meeting that we are having now, which is called adjourning.